You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, do we have a lot to cover today. Five economic reforms millennials should be fighting for. Jesse Meyerson writing in the Rolling Stone. I want to get into this today. The Satanic Temple has unveiled the statue that they're going to offer to Oklahoma. I've got to tell you all about that. We've got the inside skinny on why it is getting so cold in the Midwestern United States. And it's heading, actually, it's on its way here to Washington, D.C. by the hour. It's going to get down to 7 degrees here in D.C. here on the Mason-Dixon line, I believe we are, sometime tonight. So why is that? We'll answer that. And what's going on with this? And Koch groups, as Koch, actually, is how it's usually pronounced, the notorious billionaire brothers, raised more in 2012, they raised more than all the presidential candidates spent in the 2000 election. That's pretty mind-boggling. On top of that, we see Colorado, the price of pot. In fact, this story in the Financial Times right now, demand puts premium on recreational marijuana prices in Colorado. And the price of pot is skyrocketing because of demand. More and more people want to buy it. Surprise, surprise. I mean, this is how marketplaces work. And the law had specified only, I think it's 70% of what you grow has to go to the medical market. And so, or maybe it's 70% can go to the recreational, because I can't scroll down because my screen has frozen. For some reason, when I tried to read this page, something's gone wrong. Okay. In any case, the Financial Times website is getting a little flaky here. But what do you do? How do you handle these things in marketplaces that you do find some societal value in regulating in some way? Right. I mean, we do it with alcohol, and apparently alcohol taxes are low enough that bootlegging is not a big problem. Smuggling is not a big problem. Alcohol, about 50,000 people die every year in the United States from directly from alcohol. Around another 35,000 die every year indirectly from the use of alcohol. The number of people who've died from the use of recreational marijuana or even medicinal marijuana in the last 100 years is zero, as far as we can tell. So you would think that that would be something you want to regulate even more lightly, perhaps, than alcohol. But tobacco, about 500,000 Americans, and many more millions around the planet, but between 400,000 and 500,000 Americans will die of tobacco use this year. And this is, and so, you know, states try to regulate this and try to discourage the use of it by raising taxes on it. And when you get big disparities, like in Washington State, where you've got a $3 per pack tax, and then Idaho, where it's 57 cents or something like that, you get a smuggling problem, basically. So what do you do about it? J.D. Tuccilli is with us, the managing editor of Reason.com and Reason 24/7, Reason.com, Reason Magazine, on the line with us. Hey, J.D., how you doing?
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to get the libertarian take on this. Tobacco is the only product, to the best of my knowledge, maybe you know of something else, it's the only product sold in the United States legally that, when used as directed, causes death.
Well, some people would say the same about certain kinds of food, but I think we could all agree that tobacco is not the best thing for you. Health-wise, it certainly isn't, whatever pleasures a lot of people may derive from it. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of health issues related to tobacco consumption, no doubt about that.
So in a libertarian world, what do you do?
Well, I think you let people make their own decisions and shoulder the health results of the decisions they make, whether it's tobacco consumption, their diets, sedentary versus active lifestyle, very active lifestyle that might have its own risks. You know, we all make choices.
But those decisions require a certain level of information. I mean, for a marketplace to work in the way that Adam Smith might have envisioned, you have to have not only a perfect marketplace, but you have to have perfect information. Parties and counterparties have to have perfect information. And
well,
if you've got tobacco
true.
Companies
we'll
marketing
time,
an addictive and poisonous product to children with the cartoon characters, that's not a perfect information marketplace. And a lot of these tobacco taxes are used to pay for advertising to point out to people how destructive tobacco is. So, you know, it's an attempt to keep a marketplace open for an addictive drug that is destructive. You know, you could argue, I suppose, that tobacco produces some sort of euphoria. I think, you know, as a former smoker myself, my experience was that was only true for the first few weeks. And after that, it only produces withdrawal symptoms. But whatever. I mean, how are you going to provide for that perfect information if you don't charge a tax on the tobacco to pay to provide it?
I don't know that many economists argue you need perfect information. I bet you need information for sure. And we've seen smoking rates decline as it's become common knowledge that it's not good for you. I mean, the old claims that you saw back in the 20s and 30s that was actually healthful to smoke are something that would be considered less.
That wasn't just the 20s and the 30s. I remember in the 60s watching Ronald Reagan dressed up like a doctor on television saying that more doctors smoke Pell-Mells when they have a sore throat or a cold than any other. I mean, I remember that. Maybe it was the late 50s. But, yeah, anyhow, it's in my lifetime that happened.
Well, yeah, and those are laughable claims now. I mean, people, we point to those, and, you know, we make fun of them rightfully because they're nonsense. We know they're nonsense. So that you don't need perfect information. You don't need to know exactly that what tobacco does to you to know that it's not good for you. When we've seen smoking rates decline. Will they go away completely? I mean, I don't know that.
People, but one of the things that we do know is that the use of tobacco causes an increase in all of our expenses as a consequence of a lack of productivity, death and disease associated with that, and the cause to public health of people who smoke who are not insured and getting smoking-related diseases. So if the use of this product is costing us money, if the externality of the tobacco industry is that we are all having to pay these extra expenses, shouldn't we capture that externality with taxes?
Well, you can make the same argument about almost every lifestyle choice we make, though. I mean, that could be everything from hang gliding to sedentary lifestyles to a bad diet. People make choices that are non-optimal all the time. All of us do. I don't think.
But wait a minute. Are you saying that a product that when a product is sold and it produces an externality that is measurable and monetizable, you know, like, for example, you know, pumping poisonous gas into the atmosphere while you're refining gasoline, that the society should not be able to recover the cost of that, or that the oil company shouldn't at least pay for the cost of that externality?
Except that you're assuming that societies have to necessarily assume those costs. Now, you were talking about workplace productivity. That's something that we all make. You know, if we wake up in the morning with a hangover,
productivity and the cost and medical costs.
Excuse me?
And medical costs.
Well, medical costs are also related to everything else. You can wake up in the morning, you can drink too much, you can eat a poor diet. None of us
we pay for lifestyle. We tax drinking heavily enough to cover the cost of that externality, at least in theory.
Well, except I'm not sure that your employer would say the same thing. Those taxes are going to the government. Your employer loses the productivity. You show up nursing a hangover the next day. The costs are spread in a lot of different areas, and none of us lives an optimal lifestyle. Those costs are all over the place.
Okay.
When you talk about taxes, you're talking about the government taking that money. The government may offset some externalities, but externalities go all over the place.
Okay. J.D., we're out of time. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
J.D. Tuccelli, the managing editor of Reason.com, Reason 24/7. You can read it over at Reason.com. Thanks, J.D.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Welcome back. Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, 10 years later, Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have won?
Yeah, I mean, if we think back to when the Iraqi war started and when we were brought into the country under bad, if not downright lies, and intel- faulty intelligence, there was a lot of notion that the country wasn't doing that bad with Saddam in power. I mean, there was thriving towns, and one of those towns that was thriving under Saddam was Fallujah, and it happened to be one of the biggest battles during the Iraq War. And we found out this weekend that Al-Qaeda has now taken a sizable amount of control over Fallujah and Ramadi, which is another one of the major cities that we went after when we invaded the country. And it really shows just how destabilized the country became after the U.S. involvement. It's really a terrible thing.
Yeah. It really is, and this is, the bungling of George Bush is just absolutely breathtaking.
I mean, there's still hundreds of small villages throughout Iraq that are without power and without water, and they actually had it before we invaded. It's a direct result of our actions. It's
right.
Just a very destabilized situation.
So Robert Perry is going to drop by?
Yeah, we'll have Robert Perry on to talk about it. He's an investigative journalist, and he's always great. Should be a good segment.
Yeah. In fact, I think I'm pretty sure you should fact check this. I think that he's the guy who tracked down Mickey Herskowitz, who was hired by the Bush family to write A Charge to Keep, George Bush's autobiography, in 2000 or 1999. And Mickey was the guy who interviewed George Bush, and Bush told him that, you know, if I become president, I'm going to invade Iraq to get political capital to get what I want done. So if Perry is that guy, be sure and tell me tonight. And
yeah, we'll definitely look into that.
In our screwed segment, the NSA won't deny that it's spying on Congress.
Yeah, last week, Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont sent an open letter to the NSA director, Keith Alexander, and flat out asked, are you spying on members of Congress? Of course, when the NSA has come out saying they're storing metadata on all Americans, it's kind of an assumption that congressional lawmakers would be included in that. But it just really goes to show how frightening it is, the expansive powers of the NSA.
Yeah, it really does. And Beatrice Edwards, the executive director of the Government Accountability Project, is going to be with us?
Yeah, she'll be on to talk about that and how we can curb the expansive powers of the NSA.
Okay. And Kevin Orr, the little dictator appointed by Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, to oversee Detroit, is going to freeze the pensions on Detroit workers?
Yeah, it looks like the temperatures aren't the only things freezing up in the Motor City. Kevin Orr, very subtly over the weekend, it actually might have been on Friday, has decided to freeze the pensions of Detroit workers who are already suffering because of the very poor economic state of that city. And it's really just another kick in the gut for the working class up in the Motor City.
All right. Yeah, it really is. And Pastor Bullock is going to be on with us about that.
Yep.
We're going to correct 60 Minutes.
Yeah, we're in tonight's Politically Corrected. We're going to go after 60 Minutes and correct them. They recently aired a segment, I believe it was on Sunday's episode, about really, you could say they attacked clean energy. And we'll talk about why they're attacking that and really get into this bigger picture of corporatized media, where the money the corporation gives dictates what we see on TV.
Yeah. And decoding your dog and everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, we'll learn about what dog behaviors really mean and correct what misconceptions there are about dogs.
There you go. Andrew Campbell, senior producer of The Big Picture. Thank you, Andrew. We'll be back. Back over at the FT page, and it just locked up on me again. I don't get it. Anyhow, they say that the supply squeeze is partly due to how Colorado has set up its retail market for the first 9 months of the year. Dispensaries must grow 70% of what they sell, and growers must sell 70% of what they grow through their own retail outlets, forcing vertical integration. Interesting. The following pages have become unresponsive. Okay, we'll kill the page. So I don't know what's going on with FT, but anyway, that's so supply and demand. Climate. I wanted to talk about climate. The all over the right wing sphere, there are people saying, "Look at how cold it is. How can you say there's global warming?" Well, here's what's going on. Global warming is reducing the temperature difference between the equatorial regions and the polar regions, because the polar regions are warming four times faster than the equatorial regions. The center of the Earth, the middle of the Earth is not warming as fast as the poles. And this is, there's a whole bunch of atmosphere physics that has to do with that. But basically, that difference, that temperature gradient, in other words, that difference between temperatures of air at different latitudes is what accounts for the speed and intensity of and the patterns of the flow of air as it goes around the Earth in response to the Earth spinning on its axis. You with me? Okay, the Earth is spinning, the atmosphere is spinning a little more slowly, and we call that wind. And in that wind, there are currents that are associated with temperatures. And one of those big currents, the major one that affects temperature in North America, is called the jet stream. And the jet stream normally, you know, this time of year is flowing basically over Canada or over the northern part of North America. And it's carrying, you know, you've got cold polar air above it, and you've got warmer equatorial air and from the equator north below it, south of it. But the jet stream has been weakened. The way that Emily Atkin describes it over at Climate Progress, Think Progress's blog is the drunken jet stream. It has become weakened by the fact that the temperature difference between the air below and the air above, the air south and the air north, is not as great as it used to be. Because the Earth has warmed up about a little more than a degree in the last 30 years. And because that temperature difference is not as great, the jet stream is not as rigid as it used to be. It's waving around. And so the jet stream is dipping way south right now, and above it, of course, is this mass of polar air. So the polar air, the air that from the North Pole, is literally spilling down over the northern part of North America. It doesn't mean that the planet is getting colder. It's another sign that the planet is getting warmer. Now, I realize this may be too much for Sean Hannity to understand or the folks over at Fox News, but this is how it works. Warming up the planet doesn't just cause every place to get warmer. You know, as you've got the polar icebreaker down in the Antarctic, you've got the icebreakers that are stuck in the ice down there. What you get is global weirding. You get the extremes start popping more extreme. You get dry areas get drier, wet areas get wetter, some the other way around. Hot areas get hotter, cold areas get colder, sometimes the other way around. It all depends on where you are and depends on, you know, whether or not you have mountains around you and, you know, how the air currents are flowing and, you know, what they run into as a consequence of the spinning of the Earth and the relative temperatures. So anyhow, the net of this, if anybody says, what's this? How can you say that there's global warming when it's so damn cold out there? The simple answer is that if we had not seen a 5% increase in the amount of moisture in the upper atmosphere and a over 1 degree Celsius increase in the overall temperature of the planet and a 3 to 4 degree increase in the temperature of the polar regions over the last 30 to 40 years, we may still see what we're seeing right now, because we have seen it before. It happened back in the 70s, something close to it. But we're going to start seeing this kind of thing more frequently. Because, you know, the jet stream just doesn't have the power it used to. Okay, the Satanic Temple, the religious group based in New York City, on Monday unveiled their design for a monument they want to erect at the Oklahoma State House. This is the goat god. He's got a little boy and girl sitting next to him going, "Oh, aren't you cool?" And up above his head is the five-pointed star upside down, just like on the Republican logo. I'm still waiting for a Republican to tell me why they put the Satanic Star on their logo. But anyhow, here it is. There's this goat god. The Satanic Temple in New York City wants to offer this. It's Baphomet, B-A-P-H-O-M-E-T, is the goat-headed Egyptian god. I think he's an Egyptian god. And they say they're offered. This is State Representative Mike Ritzy, Republican from Broken Arrow, offered conservative Christians, let them erect a Ten Commandment monument on the State House grounds. And so the Satanists are saying, hey, how about us? And in fact, they're trying to raise $20,000 to build the monument. You can read all about it over at rawstory.com. Very entertaining. I'm still wondering, what's with the Republicans and the Satanists are? Any ideas?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what's wrong with goats? You know, I don't get that either. So, the goat become the Satan guy. 28 minutes past, before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The daughter of the vice president, the former vice president, Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney, has withdrawn from the primary, the Republican primary in Wyoming. And in fact, we just picked up a new station in Wyoming. I don't have it on my list here. Must have been last week. Anyway, she has withdrawn from the race, and she's saying family problems. This has, you know, who knows exactly what that means, but I think that she saw that she was losing badly and it was going to go badly because Mike Enzi looks like he's the Republican who's already holding that seat. And she was basically trying to primary him, you know, trying to do the Tea Party thing like they did in 2012 and 2010. And I don't think the Tea Party thing's going to work in 2014. Because I think the American people have woken up to the Tea Party. They have figured this thing out. They have figured out that these Tea Party groups and these other right-wing groups are, you know, well, Koch groups, Koch as in K-O-C-H, Koch groups alone raised more in 2012 than candidates spent during an entire 2000 presidential election. Report Rebecca Leber and Andrew Briner over at the Center for American Progress's blog Think Progress. A political network linked to conservative billionaires Charles and David Cloak raised at least $407 million in the last election, almost matching Mitt Romney's campaign funds. By comparison, the Koch network raised more than George W. Bush did in 2004 and outdid both presidential candidates in 2000. Wow. How can you have a democracy when speech, when money is considered protected by the First Amendment, and the two guys who, if they were one guy, would be the richest or the second richest man on earth, are throwing more, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars or helping pull together hundreds of millions of dollars through organizations that they've helped form to accomplish particular political goals. And among those are things like, you know, the, you know, promoting libertarianism and promoting the so-called Tea Party. I think people are getting it, that the Tea Party agenda is basically the billionaire agenda, and it's not necessarily the agenda of good Americans, of Americans. I don't mean good Americans. I mean, you know, of average working Americans. Not to say that the Koch brothers are not good Americans. That's not what I meant. Everybody's entitled to their political opinion and to spend the money they want under the law. I think the law should be changed, but, you know, that's... But anyhow, I think that Liz Cheney is dropping out of this race because people are catching on, and that's one of the reasons why these guys are having to spend so many hundreds of millions of dollars to accomplish what they have done, which is basically just kind of hold at bay the genuinely progressive nature of America. I mean, you hear this thing in the media all the time, America's a center-right nation. We are not a center-right nation. It's a lie. Ain't true. And all you have to do is just poll people based on the issues that define left and right. You know, do most Republicans think that long-term unemployment benefits should be extended during a time of recession? Yes. Now, the Republicans are not going to do it, it appears. Eric Cantor, who is a piece in the Washington Post, was it yesterday or this morning, about how he's the speaker in waiting now, on the expectation that Boehner is going to step down next year and hand the magic gavel over to Eric Cantor, assuming that the Republicans can hold the House. I mean, keep in mind, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes for members of the House of Representatives in the last election than did Republicans. The only reason Republicans hold the House is because of the way that those votes were distributed, because of gerrymandering. But in any case, we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But I think that, you know, unemployment insurance, most Americans are with the Democrats on this. And the Democrats are going to start using this as a club against the Republicans. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see. Harry Reid is calling for a vote on this today or tomorrow. In the House of Representatives, John Boehner is refusing to, you know, bring it up. And meanwhile, you got 1.3 million people who just lost their unemployment checks. And that's going to cause a drop of 0.4% in our GDP. And people are wondering why the stock market is starting to tremble. Republicans want a crash, and they want it on Obama's watch, so that they can point to it and say, see, this is what you get with a Democrat. But Americans, I really think, and I mean, like I said, you can go through the issues. Social Security, Medicare, unemployment, Medicaid. Should pot be decriminalized? Should gay marriage be available? Should women have the right to choose whether or not to get an abortion, at least in the first trimester or the first, before viability, which I guess is how it's defined by Roe v. Wade, more or less. The vast majority of Americans agree with all of those positions. Should God be part of America, part of our American politics? When you put it in the context of, well, should there be a 7-foot statue of a goat-headed god at the Oklahoma State House? Most Americans start getting very serious about separation of church and state. This is hysterical. I mean, just give them a chance to think about it a little bit. And what you find is that we are what, I don't know if you could call it center left or even left. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I think, represents the perspective of the mainstream of Americans, and he calls himself a democratic socialist, as in European socialism, not as in Soviet socialism. Like, let's run this country like Denmark. And I'm there with him. So how much more are they going to have to raise? The Washington Post did a great expose on all the coctopus, this network of interlocking companies and ways that billionaires can give money and anonymously and not be known. So there's that. Back to the original, the question that I'd asked in the very beginning when we had the fellow from Reason on. What do you do about tobacco? If we were to triple tobacco taxes, this is one of the things that we know, is that as the cost of tobacco goes up, use goes down. We do know that. And Reuters reports, tripling tobacco taxes globally could cut smoking by a third and prevent 200 million premature deaths this century from lung cancer and other diseases. Tobacco kills around 6 million people a year, expected to rise above 8 million by 2030. Tobacco is killing more people than AIDS, killing more people than malaria. Hiking taxes a large amount per cigarette would encourage people to quit smoking altogether rather than switching to cheaper brands. Is that the way to do it? Or should we ban it? I don't think so. I don't think we can. I don't think we should ban it. I hold to my position that if you can grow it in your backyard, it should be at least not illegal. But I think that tobacco should be at least as tightly regulated as marijuana is in the state of Colorado. Right. And well taxed. I mean, they're paying what, $400 an ounce for pot right now in the retail stores in Colorado? If you sold tobacco for $400 an ounce, you'd have some, you know, real hardcore tobacco smokers who would still buy it. But I think most people say, nah, no thanks. So your thoughts on that? Well, we can get into all these things as we go on through the day, through the week. NAFTA, this is The Guardian published this piece on Saturday. I thought this was fascinating. NAFTA, 20 years of regret for Mexico. Mexico's economic growth stalled since the free trade deal was signed with the U.S., and its poverty rate is about the same. Mark Weisbrot wrote this. He's been a guest on our program a number of times. And he says, NAFTA was not only a bad deal for Americans, but it was a bad deal for Mexicans. He said this, you know, from the 60s to the 80s, Mexico's GDP per capita nearly doubled. That's a good thing. You know, they were growing. But then they signed NAFTA, and they stopped growing. Instead, they deregulated their international trade and investment and tightened up their monetary policies. In other words, they went with Reaganomics. They went with Milton Friedmanomics. They went with what are called neoliberal policies, what you might call conservative economic policies. And the consequence of that was that growth stopped, poverty increased, a lot of people fled Mexico to come to the United States. Meanwhile, we were subsidizing the production of corn, which was driving down corn prices in Mexico, which was driving farmers off their, you know, subsistence farmers off their farms and into the cities, and in many cases into our cities. And the last thing, well, not the last thing, actually, there's a couple of other things here that I wanted to get. The 60 Minutes hit job on clean energy. This is incredible. And Jess Meyerson suggesting five things millennials should be fighting for. We'll get into all of these. And your calls. Actually, we'll pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Right after the break, 15 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Gerald in Lake Wales, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Oh, fine, Tom. Excuse me. My name is Gerald, as you said, and I wanted a little update from you, if I could get it, on the Fukushima disaster.
Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge, things are static. We had Kevin Camp on our TV show last Thursday, as I recall, and from beyondnuclear.org, and there was some concern because people were seeing steam coming out of Unit 3. Turns out that the reason that steam was visible, and it wasn't visible before, was because a cold air mass was passing over the area. And just like you can see your breath on a cold day and you can't see your breath on a normal day, that steam had always been there. It just, you know, or that moisture, that you know, level of moisture had always been there. It just became more evident because of the change in the weather. So it doesn't look like anything has changed dramatically. There's still pouring radioactive material into the ocean. It's still pouring radioactive material into the sky. I asked Kevin if the reactor 4, which is where they've got a full load of, you know, relatively new nuclear fuel that was about to be put into the reactor in a holding tank, a water tank, five stories above the ground, and that building is listing. And they were going to go in and try to pull those rods out one at a time, like pulling cigarettes out of a crushed cigarette package, and try to do so without breaking them. And that's the thing that's got everybody very, very nervous. And Kevin said that nobody knows. They were supposed to start that this month or last month. Whether they've started it or not, nobody knows. The reporting on it, nobody's really sure of. And the thing is that Japan has passed a new state secrets law that clamps down on reporters and makes it harder to get information and increases the penalties for leaking information. and gives the government the ability to more aggressively restrict access to areas that they consider relevant to the national security. And they are applying that state secrets law to Fukushima. And so we don't really know what's going on. And neither does the Japanese public, and the reporters are not being allowed into the region.
Well, Coase did a program on that years ago with Harold Braun, and he went over a lot of issues, mainly rust and corrosion in the containment tanks.
Yeah,
and they all have the same manufacturing defect. And there's 15 power plants in Tennessee there that were intentionally built on known earthquake fault lines. There's more than that, but I'm just talking about Tennessee. So
yeah,
they still have the rust and corrosion problem that they can't fix.
Well, yeah, and we've got between 30 and 50, I don't remember the exact number, of these Mark 1 or Mark 2 reactors, these General Electric boiling water reactors here in the United States that are the same as several of the ones at Fukushima that melted down. So, you know, we've got a serious problem, Gerald. I'm with you on this. I'm sorry I don't know more about it, and I don't think anybody does. But if you go over to beyondnuclear.org, they've been our go-to source for keeping up to date on this thing. So thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Justin in Quebec, Canada. Hey, Justin, you had a question or comment about climate change?
Yeah, hi, I did. I just wanted to get your opinion on the idea that though it's important for the U.S. to reduce its emissions, can we really do much considering the fact that if we don't get China and India on board, there will be no real reduction in emissions no matter what the OECD does or Western countries?
That's, you know, it's a good topic to raise. I wouldn't raise it in that frame, though. First of all, China is building out solar infrastructure faster than we are, and we've built more solar infrastructure, at least in the state of California, they've built more in the last year than they did in the previous decade. I mean, we're really, really starting to grow. And if you take away the subsidies for fossil fuels, then both solar and wind are more economical right across the board pretty much everywhere in the world. So, yeah, I think, you know, we can do that. I think other countries can do that. And yeah, just because somebody else is not doing the right thing doesn't mean you shouldn't do the right thing. Is that what you're suggesting?
No.
It's sort of like saying, you know, the guy next door is a heroin addict, so I think I will too.
No, I'm not disagreeing that it's important. I'm not a climate skeptic or anything like that, but I just don't really see what we can do. There are a billion-plus people compared to maybe in the United States and Canada, 350, 360 million people.
Right, but our carbon – but hang on, just pause right there, Justin. Our carbon footprint is so much larger that our 300 million people represent 25% of the planet's carbon footprint, whereas China's 1 billion people represent about 20% of the planet's carbon footprint. And just 30 years ago, they were, you know, less than 3%. India's billion-plus people are 5 or 10% of the planet's carbon footprint. It's relatively small. I've been through rural India. I mean, there are large stretches of India where, you know, people are, you know, they're not using any fossil fuels whatsoever. They're not even using electricity. So, and what's happening is in a lot of these rural villages, they're electrifying for the first time by bringing in solar collectors. They're not bringing electricity in. They're bringing in solar panels.
But don't you worry that if we take, I'm not saying do nothing, maybe a carbon price or a carbon tax would help. But don't you worry if we take massive reductions or new cost on fossil fuels, that you'd have a lot of the manufacturing industry move to China or India if they're not doing it. They'd move to the lowest cost area.
I don't think that the two are related. Companies move to low-cost areas because they can. And, you know, when we had tariffs in the United States and we said, if you want to sell goods to our people, if you want access to our marketplace, you're going to have to pay for access to that marketplace. And so, you know, if something's imported into the United States, there's a 20 or 30% import tax at the border. When we had those tariffs, then manufacturers kept their manufacturing in the United States, whether it was manufacturing steel or whether it was manufacturing solar plants or whether it was manufacturing, you know, gas-fired or coal-fired power plants.
So you level the playing field.
Of course. Of course. You know, I mean, you go back to, you know, if it costs, you know, a dollar for the labor to make a pair of shoes in North Carolina, and it costs 50 cents to make that pair of shoes in terms of labor in Mexico, and 20 cents in terms of labor to make that pair of shoes in Vietnam, then you put an 80-cent tariff on Vietnam, a 50-cent tariff on Mexico, and you know, basically the cost of wherever you get shoes from, it's going to cost you a buck in terms of the effective labor cost, and that causes manufacturing to stay in the United States. This is a principle that was laid out by Alexander Hamilton in
his report on manufacturing.
Right, his report on manufacturers in 1791 to Congress, and was instituted by the Washington administration in 1793 and stood until Reagan became president, basically, and started passing out most favored nation status and these bilateral trade deals, and then Bill Clinton started doing, you know, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and GATT, and all that kind of stuff. So I think that we've, you know, we thought that globalization was going to produce some wonderful result. It hasn't. But that has nothing to do with, you know, I mean, there is some relationship, I suppose, between that and global carbon emissions. But whether we should, and any other country in the world, or any other state should be reducing their carbon emissions just because China or India aren't or are not, that doesn't make any sense to me. And like I said, China and India are both aggressively building out solar, in ways that are just really quite spectacular. China in particular, it's just that their growth, because of our trade policies, has been so fast that it's outstripped their ability to solarize. Justin, thanks for the call. Mary in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Hey, Mary, you have ideas about what to do about tobacco?
Well, a couple ideas. One, the harder you make it for people to smoke, the more likely they are to quit. So one is restricting areas of smoking, and secondly is increasing the taxes on a pack of cigarettes. But I really dislike the libertarian idea that there should be no consequences, that the marketplace should handle all these ills. I'm a person who is extremely allergic to cigarette smoke. I have multiple chemical sensitivities, which means I lose weight, my sinuses bleed, I pay for exposure to cigarette smoke like crazy, and I think it's ridiculous to think that addicts, because that is what cigarette smoking is, it's an addiction, are going to control themselves. And wouldn't libertarians use this argument if it were applied to drinking and driving? I mean, because we could go that we had no social consequences or economic consequences for drinking and driving until MAD got legislation on the books. So,
There was legislation before MAD, but MAD really tightened it up and got it a lot tougher. I was surprised, frankly, that our libertarian guest did not have a solution. You know, because like you say, with drinking and driving, I mean, there's a clear social ill there, and we have penalties for that. And I don't think that the libertarian's position is that it should be perfectly legal to drink and drive. Although maybe it is. I don't know. But, you know, should it be legal to kill yourself by being addicted to a poisonous substance? That's where the libertarians would say yes, and where I would say, well, yeah, we're going to make it legal, but let's at least make it difficult or expensive. I kind of run out of that argument. Mary, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It is 28. No, it's 2 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. You know, the Republicans on Capitol Hill, actually Republicans everywhere, say we're all about cutting the national debt and slashing the outrageous levels of government spending. You know, best way to fix the country's economy is austerity. We can cut our way to prosperity. No other country's ever done it before in the history of the United States, but we can do it. No. When Paul Ryan and his buddies talk about slashing government spending, what they're really saying is they don't want government money going to working class or poor Americans. They got no problem at all when that government spending is going to their millionaire and billionaire buddies who run America's giant health insurance corporations. And in the process of handing over money to corporate executives, Republicans are costing American taxpayers and the economy trillions of dollars. For example, if the Republicans hadn't fought President Obama over a public option or even a single-payer system under Obamacare, and we had followed the path of Medicare's rollout in 1966, which the Republicans didn't like, but they didn't, like, lay down in the street. They didn't vote over and over and over and over and over again in the House of Representatives to repeal. They just said, okay, you guys win. If we had followed the path of Medicare's rollout in 66, we would have saved billions of dollars. PNHP.org, Physicians for National Health Program, did a study on this, and what they found, these researchers at the City University of New York, that's CUNY, isn't it? Is that how they say it, CUNY? That when all is said and done, the costs of getting Obamacare up and running and enrolling 7 million Americans in the program in the first year are going to total about $6 billion. So that's about roughly $90 a person. You compare that to the cost of Medicare's rollout back in 1966. According to the CUNY researchers, Medicare's costs in the first year totaled $867 million in today's dollars. That's roughly $5.1 billion less than what Obamacare is costing in its first year. And within 11 months of LBJ signing Medicare into law, 19 million people, senior citizens, had signed up for it. That's 99% of everybody who is eligible. So why was the 1966 Medicare rollout so cheap compared to the Obamacare rollout? It was cheaper because back then Republicans weren't shilling for their billionaire friends in the health industry by opposing a single-payer system or a public option. Because Medicare is single-payer. Dr. David Himmelstein, one of the CUNY researchers, put it, the simple single-payer Medicare for All approach would save more than $400 billion annually on bureaucracy. Enough to give every American first dollar coverage. But to get those savings, you have to break private insurers' stranglehold on health care and on Washington. He added, Obamacare is a giant workaround crafted to keep private insurers at the center of the health care system. So, simply put, a single-payer health care system, which excludes billionaire private insurers and the influences they have over Republicans in Washington, could save our country billions of dollars. And we don't have it. That's the bad news. Now, here's the good news. There's a backdoor built into Obamacare, which lets the individual states create their own single-payer health care system starting in 2016. And at least one state has already jumped on board. Back in 2011, the Vermont state government enacted a law creating the nation's first state-level single-payer health care system. It's called Green Mountain Care. Kaiser Family Foundation describes Green Mountain Care as a state-funded and managed insurance pool that would provide near-universal coverage to residents with the expectation that it would reduce health care spending. In a blog post for the Huffington Post, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin, who has been on this program and talked about this, said that Green Mountain Care is a single-payer system that will control health care costs, not just by cutting fees to doctors and hospitals, but by fundamentally changing the state's health care system. Seeing the support that a single-payer health care system has gained in Vermont, other states are beginning to follow suit. Right now, lawmakers in Montana are working hard to establish a single-payer system in that state. Slowly but surely, more and more states are going to realize the overwhelming benefits of a single-payer healthcare system. Like, mostly, it cuts your costs in half. And once that happens, we can expect to see the Canadian experience all over again. You know, in Canada, they did this in Saskatchewan, and it worked so well that every other province said, hey, we want that. So I think it's, you know, quite possible that by 2020, we're going to have a system of state run single-payer systems here in the United States, just like there is province by province in Canada, you know, overseen by the federal government. But here's the sad part of this. This should have happened years ago. I mean, we should have done this. We could have done this before Canada did. But, you know, Republican obstructionism, we've had to spend years getting to a rational and cost-effective healthcare system, and we're not even there yet. When it could have been done 69 years ago, when President Harry Truman first proposed the legislation back in November of 1945. That was when we first proposed single-payer legislation. Over the past 69 years, people have been dying and going bankrupt for lack of health care because of the Republican commitment to their health care billionaires. Now, Obamacare is a start, but it's only a piece of the puzzle. America needs a single-payer health care system, and we need it now. Congressman John Conyers has once again introduced House Resolution 676, the United States National Health Care Act, which calls for the creation of a single-payer health care system here in the United States. We could do this. Make single-payer health care system a reality in America. We can't do it with the Republicans controlling the House of Representatives, or able to filibuster legislation in the Senate, as long as the Supreme Court continues to say that money is protected under the First Amendment and so billionaires can buy politicians. We can't do it under those circumstances. But we can do it with Obamacare having this backdoor to single-payer health care, where it says that individual states can do their own programs. They can do their own, you know, programs. It'll work. So how cool is that, right? Jesse A. Meyerson in Rolling Stone just came out with a piece called Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For. Young people, pay attention. Number one, guaranteed work for everybody. This is, I call this, you know, government as the employer of last resort. We did this in the 1930s. We did it in the 1940s. We did it somewhat in the 1950s. And then we didn't need to do it again until Reaganomics really took hold. Now we need to do it all over again. Number two, Social Security for all. And what he's talking about here is a basic universal income. Everybody gets a couple thousand bucks a month, period. And then you go to work and you make more money, you know, on top of that. Number three, take back the land. This is a land value tax. Now, this is a fairly complex thing. I'm not going to get into the details of this, but make everything owned by everybody. This is collectivizing wealth ownership. This is creating a sovereign wealth fund. We could discuss that. And a public bank in every state, number five. And that's something that I think, you know, tomorrow morning, every state should do. There's a big initiative in California to create a California state bank. It should be done.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
North Dakota has one, and with that bank, with that state bank, all the profit that that bank makes goes right back into the state and helps out the people. And welcome back. Ed, watching Free Speech TV on your cable system there in Seattle. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. I don't usually let my views be known very well. I was going to just talk to you a little bit about what I think is wrong with the world.
What do you think is wrong with the world, Ed?
Well, you know, we're all animals on this planet, and animals grow by dominance and aggression, by greed and selfishness.
Actually, not true. Animals grow by cooperation.
Yes, they do. But basically, they grow by dominance and aggression, by greed and selfishness.
Not true.
If you watch a wolf pack, or you watch chickens in the pen, or you watch the hogs,
right,
or horses, or any of the animals, that's the way they grow.
Well, if you put them in a pen, they'll behave differently. But if you watch a wolf pack in the wild, you'll see that they cooperate with each other.
Family cooperates. That's right.
And
that's all part of life and supporting yourself and growing your group.
Right. Right.
But
now they may dominate the animals that they eat because they're predators, but that's a different thing.
They dominate in the pack.
Well, in the pack, yeah, there will be, and actually there's two hierarchies in a wolf pack. There is a sexual hierarchy, and there is a hunting hierarchy, as it were, and which has to do with skills. But in any case, I'm sorry, I stopped you in mid-sentence. Continue with your thought.
Well, we are different than the other animals in that we have knowledge and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the ability to make choices and to seek harmony in our choices. And if we do that, basically that's all we have to do. You know, we're different than the other animals in that we have a soul that goes on after us. When we die, our soul goes on.
How do you know the animals don't?
You know, I really don't, other than... From what I've noticed, you know, I had a dog and loved my dog and felt my dog was a part of me. And I would like to think that he went on to something else. But we have our literature that goes back to Sumerians that say that we were given this knowledge and understanding and we have the ability to make choices.
Yeah.
And it's the difference of whether or not we continue our evolution goes from the physical to the spiritual.
I don't disagree in broad stroke. My guess is that everything that has consciousness, which is everything alive, and maybe even the stuff that's not alive, like came out of the light and goes back to the light, my cat Higgins came out of the light, became a kitten, became a cat, then when he died, he went back into the light. That you and I, Ed, came out of the light. We're going to, you know, be here on this earth for a while, and then we'll go back to the light. And you could define the light as whatever, you know. That's my personal epistemology.
But I see it as, not necessarily all the Republicans, but the people that are dominant and aggressive, greedy and selfish, and they're trying to take control of everybody else.
Yeah, that's going on. And see, I think that is not the norm in nature. That is, in fact, when you see in your body some cells rose up and said, we're going to take over, that's called cancer. And I think what we're seeing is a cancer in our society. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Okay, I promised you a riff on this hit piece that 60 Minutes did on clean energy. And it's 60 Minutes, the Sunday news show. Prior to 78, when we had what was called the Fairness Doctrine in place, it required that radio and TV stations program in the public interest. And the way that they did that, it had nothing to do with if you have an hour of Tom Hartman, you have to have an hour of Rush Limbaugh or vice versa. What it said was, if you are programming, you have to have some programming in the public interest. Some of that was, you do things like you say, you know, here's the public calendar for events going on in the community, whatever, you know, you talk about the community. But the main way that radio and TV stations did that was they provided news. And there was competition for the quality of that news, and sometimes investigative reporting was a big part of that. And that's, 60 Minutes kind of came out of that environment back in the day. And they used to do some pretty aggressive, hard-hitting investigative reporting. But then in 1987, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman, excuse me, the Fairness Doctrine. And in 96, Bill Clinton basically killed the infrastructure within which it operated by signing the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And combined with in 82 and 83, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, allowing these huge aggregations of media companies, both radio and television, and newspapers. And the net of all this, the bottom line was that by the end of 96, by 1997, we no longer had news in the United States. We had stuff that was called news, and we continue to. But the decisions about what stories to go with, do we go with Balloon Boy? Do we go with the O.J. Simpson case? Do we go with Trayvon Martin? Do we go with, you know, what do we go with? The decision of what story to go with and how to rank them by, quote, news organizations, end quote, is made based on money now instead of based on what is it important for the electorate to know, to have that informed electorate that Thomas Jefferson said was necessary to a functioning democracy, which is why we had the Fairness Doctrine. And so the consequence of that is that now the purpose of, quote, news shows or even magazine shows or any kind of show is to make money. And, you know, that's the number one goal, at, particularly at the network level. When you're talking, you know, really, you're talking millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. So if the fossil fuel industry is throwing tens or hundreds of millions of dollars at your network and your affiliates to advertise their products, are you really going to go after them? Or might you go after the people that they compete with? Now, I'm not asserting that I know why 60 Minutes did basically a hit piece on clean energy. I don't. I don't know the thinking that went into it. I wasn't privy to the conversations. But I do know that Joe Rahm did a brilliant takedown of their hit piece that's really worth reading over at the Center for American Progress's Climate Progress. ThinkProgress.org is the blog. Click on the little green climate stuff, and here's Joe Rahm's piece. And he said, you know, Sunday's absurd 60-minute piece touting an emergency clean tech crash. And he points out how, you know, in the United States, the installed wind capacity has just exploded in the last 10 years, 12 years. While the price has dropped, the price has gone from, in 1980, it was 55 cents a kilowatt hour to produce wind power. Now it's 7 cents a kilowatt hour to produce wind power. And so we've gone from, in 1980, virtually no wind power measurable, you know, less than a single billion watts, gigawatts, less than one, to over 60 gigawatts. Now, a gigawatt is basically a nuclear power plant. We've gone to 60 of those in the United States today in wind power, just wind power. So the price has collapsed. The use of it has exploded. LED lights. In 2008, LED lighting cost $150 for 1,000 lumens. A lumen is a unit of brightness, and there's, I don't know, maybe, I don't know how many lumens are in a 100-watt bulb. It's less than 100, but in any case, for 1,000 lumens, it cost $150 roughly in 2008. Now it's around $20. And so LED lighting has gone from being basically unmeasurable in 2008 to over 20 million LED lights installed now. And that, we're talking about lights to light things, not lights like, you know, on your dashboard. And it's like Leslie Stahl goes right to Solyndra, one company that failed, the one that the Republicans love to talk about, that was part of the Obama stimulus, without talking about all the programs that worked so well. Venture capital secret, 3 out of 4 startups fail.
Right.
The cost of electric vehicles and batteries. Well, I could just go on and on. I mean, it's just basically, so it's like, you know, why did 60 Minutes do this? Why? I suspect at the end of the day, it has something to do with cash. Don't know, but I'm guessing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It said there certainly wasn't a 60 Minutes piece about, you know, how the gas and oil sector, which advertises so heavily with them, is getting subsidized. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very erexogenically ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, the Amiens Goodyear workers. You don't need to look any farther than France to see that the worldwide labor movement is alive and kicking. Earlier today, workers at the Goodyear plant in, I think it's Amiens, France, maybe it's Amiens, used tires, the same tires made at their plant, to barricade their bosses in a meeting room. The workers decided to trap their bosses after a meeting failed to resolve an ongoing labor dispute. I think it's just safe to say that the Amiens Goodyear workers are really on a roll. The bad, Richard Mack, the former Graham County, Arizona sheriff, is outraged that a federal judge recently struck down Utah's ban on same-sex marriage. So outraged, in fact, that he's joining up with the so-called Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association in calling for an uprising against the gay agenda. Mack told local news that he just wants the homosexuals to stop shoving their agenda down our throats. Seriously, check it out.
The people of Utah have rights too, not just the homosexuals. The homosexuals are shoving their agenda down our throats.
Let's play that one more time, just for good measure.
The people of Utah have rights too, not just the homosexuals. The homosexuals are shoving their agenda down our throats.
Some jokes just write themselves. And the very, very ugly Rand Paul. The Kentucky senator is one of the more vocal opponents of extending long-term unemployment benefits. He recently told Fox News that doing so would be a disservice to the unemployed. But here's the thing. Rand Paul is doing a disservice to the unemployed himself, especially the unemployed in his own state. Extra cash in the form of unemployment insurance gives people without a job the time, confidence, and security to pound the pavement looking for work. But thanks to Rand Paul's refusal to extend benefits, 4 in every 1,000 Kentucky residents have now lost their last lifeline. According to a new study, this puts Kentucky near the top of the list of states most affected, most harmed by the expiration of unemployment benefits. Basically, Rand Paul has put politics over the economic well-being of the people who put him into office. And that is just very, very ugly. And rather amazing, really, when you think about it. Oh, this is interesting. This is from the Nation blog, and I can't verify the truth of this beyond And in fact, what they're saying is that this has to do with why the 60 Minutes got the Benghazi story so wrong, you know, that Laura Logan has apologized for and everything else. But it says, but here's another angle that's gotten little attention so far. Few seem to realize that a former Fox News executive became the head of CBS News in February 2011. His bio at CBS declares he directs network news gathering for all CBS News platforms, including television, CBSNews.com, and CBS News Radio. With CBS News chairman, he has led a division-wide rejuvenation of the storied CBS News brand, emphasizing the original reporting of top broadcast journalists around the world. He began his career as a production assistant at the newly launched Fox News Channel in 1996, where he later became vice president of news. At the Fox Network, he managed coverage of three presidential elections, war in Afghanistan and Iraq, hurricanes including Katrina, and was the channel's assistant manager on the news desk on the morning of 9/11. So, could it be? Like we said, you know, some jokes write themselves, some stories write themselves. Sometimes you can just draw your own conclusions. Dave in Seattle. Hey, Dave, you have some theories on why 60 Minutes would... misrepresent. I'm not sure that's the right word, but
well,
why they would do a hit piece on it.
I almost feel a little bit embarrassed to bring this up because I was going to bring up that thing which you just reported.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're confirming that that this fellow I didn't say his name on the air because I wasn't sure that
I was about to bring that up. It appeared to be to me as an outside observer that CBS was turning into Fox Lite. They had sort of given up their news touting ability when they decided earlier on last year to have CNN be their on-site film crew.
Right.
And they were going to go down that route. Now, they backed off from that because there was a lot of public furor over that. But I really wasn't even going to talk very much. That was going to be an aside, but that they appear to be going into the Fox light.
That's very interesting. I wonder if the big three networks are looking at, you know, what's going on in cable. And NBC, of course, has the MSNBC brand, which is the, quote, liberal brand. And so NBC is broadly more perceived as the, quote, liberal channel. And, you know, even their national election coverage, they bring in their MSNBC reporters, people like Chris Matthews, who's fairly openly Democratic at the very least, big
right.
D Democratic. And so CBS is saying, well, gee, if there's, a liberal space in the marketplace, there must be a conservative space in the marketplace. We can fill that, and so we will become the Fox News of network television instead of cable television. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
And that, which leaves ABC where? I mean,
leaves ABC hanging out in the entertainment division because ABC is Disney.
That's right. And so ABC is going to go for Lassie.
ABC is going to go for Disney, but you have to remember that the person who is leading the face, shall we say, of ABC News, Diane Sawyer, is an old Nixon appointee.
That's right. That's right. Although, you know,
directly.
I do know Diane Sawyer worked for Nixon and you know was very in with Nixon, but you know I'm willing to give people credit for changing over the years, aren't you?
I am too. I have to admit, at one point in time, I was a Republican, but that was before Ronald Reagan got there.
Yeah, and you know there was 6 months or so where I thought I was a libertarian, but Diane Sawyer does not strike me as an ideologue.
No, but she hides well. She masks well, and she learned that in the Nixon administration when she misspoke and gave out the report that Nixon himself wanted to give out,
well, that's
which is why she got fired.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Well, it's an interesting theory, Dave. CBS is basically just trying to grab the Fox crowd on the network side rather than just the cable side.
Right. The other thing I wanted to just point up, and this is kind of like, don't be afraid if people call you part of the Tin Hat Brigade. And I'm now referring to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you're speaking to the audience, I mean.
I'm speaking to the audience. I'm speaking to the audience on this one. In the sense of, I perceived when I watched the entire 60 Minutes broadcast through the four stories that they had, that there was a same tenet going on. It wasn't just that they were pro the standard line of, well, let's keep our what's going on now in the tech industry and,
yeah,
and
get status quo,
high tech people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was also there when dealing with internet. Can't rely upon the internet, because here's a guy who's going to be a crook on the internet. There's our second story. Oh, and we can't rely upon other things, because of course we know volcanoes have caused more direct measurable warming or cooling, as the case may be, because when they talked about the winter without,
right,
or the summer without,
the year without a summer, yeah.
Yeah, year without a summer, on their volcano story. And you can't trust even the foreign dignitaries when they're appearing to do something good, and that was their closure, their Putin story. I say it's a pattern.
Hmm.
And when one starts talking about patterns of presentation,
yeah,
at that moment in time, you begin, a person becomes funneled into, you're part of the Tin Hat Brigade.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think so. The pattern makes perfect sense to me, and I don't think that I'm walking around with a tinfoil hat on. And,
I don't feel that I am either, but I have come up to things in two elections, well, three elections ago in 2000. I was saying things like this was to anybody who would listen to me, that this was really 1932 light.
Yeah. Well, I was pretty flipped out when George W. Bush started using the word homeland, after, you know, from having lived in Germany and knowing that in 1936 or 37, 35, whatever the year was, the Nuremberg rally happened, the big rally where Hess introduced Hitler, and Hess introducing Hitler, he introduced the word homeland. And because Germany had, for thousands of years, had always been referred to as the fatherland, as der Vaterland. And instead, Hitler and Hess were both big students of Zionism and as well as anti-Semites. And they thought that the idea of a homeland, which was, you know, at the core of Zionism at that time, to create the state of Israel, the idea of a homeland would cause people to feel the idea of blut und Erde, was the phrase that Hitler and Hess used, blood and earth, that the people were connected to the soil, and that there was a national identity that was also a racial identity that could create an us and them. And I played that audio on the show many, many times of Hess saying that. And you know, when the Department of Homeland Security in the United States happened, it just sent a chill down my spine. I don't think I have a tinfoil hat on about that either. Anyhow, Dave, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
On the other hand, I think that the one of the amazing things about America is our resilience, and I think the pendulum is swinging the other direction right now. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ken, in Lebanon, Missouri, watching us on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really do appreciate your reporting. I really do. I am very concerned about, you know, this Radcast, and I think everybody in America knows it's coming from that problem in Japan. And what I don't understand is why Homeland Security, National Security, and the UN can't join together and tell Japan, if you can't fix this, we're going to come in and do it.
Well, I think that the reason why they're all not saying that is twofold. Number one, Japan's a sovereign nation, and nobody has the legal authority to violate their sovereignty. Now, you could argue that their radiation is such a huge problem that it puts them somehow in violation of UN treaties or justifies basically an invasion of Japan, you know, we're going to have to attack them to save them or that kind of thing. But number two, the bigger problem is, I don't think anybody has the technology to solve the problem. I don't think anybody knows, you know, I think every country I mean, we look at the situation and say, you know, we don't want to get involved in helping out there because we could screw it up and make things worse. I mean, you've got reactor 4 has got a full load of nuclear fuel sitting in a pool on the 5th through the 10th floor, a five floor high swimming pool, a pool of water on the top of a building that is tilting by 12 degrees, that is listing, you know, and the ground underneath it is starting to get super saturated. And if that thing goes, then, you know, you've got a pile of radioactive rubble on the ground that could make Chernobyl look like a picnic. And it's like, I think all around the world, we're avoiding it. We're hoping that the Japanese can fix it. I mean, they're throwing everything they've got at it, apparently.
Throughout the entire world, there aren't enough scientists that can figure it out if they work with
I don't think so. Ken, I don't think it's something you can figure out. I think that we have created a toxic technology that exceeds our ability to handle it. I mean, when you've got radiation levels in and around those plants where if a person is exposed to it for more than an hour or so, they are dead. And you know, where the radiation levels are so intense that you know, robotic and remotely controlled machinery won't work because the radiation scrambles the chips in them, you know, that run them. I mean, it's like, you know, when they flew over and dumped, you know, water on them and things, they had to put lead underneath the planes. I mean, you've got the sailors on the USS Ronald Reagan. There's 70 plus of them who are suing our federal government right now because they've got cancers and stuff. And these are kids in their 20s, right? Young men in their 20s who were exposed to the radiation because that ship was downwind of the plume when it went off, and Japan and TEPCO didn't warn them to get the hell out of the way. And some of the helicopters were, you know, flying in, you know, through the plume. And they brought this radiation down onto the deck of the carrier, and these soldiers and seamen were exposed to this. And it's like, you know, nobody wants to talk about it. It reveals the fragility of nuclear power in the United States. It's like no one wants to go there. So yeah, Ken, I think that, you know, nobody has the technology or the ability, and that's why nobody is offering it. In my opinion. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
It feels like the first day of school. This apparently is the worst day of the year.
Really? In terms of weather or in terms of John Boehner's...
People feel this way. This is considered the worst day of the year by people worldwide.
You mean every year?
The gloomiest day of the year. The first Monday after the Christmas New Year holiday. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Well, it makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, you know, the glow of the holidays is gone. And you're left with winter. And
January, February, March.
Right, yeah. And
nothing.
And all you have to look forward to is three more months of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay,
and
well.
And the polar vortex.
Yes, yes. The polar vortex, because of global warming, the temperature gradient between the mid-latitudes and the upper latitudes is not as harsh as clearly defined as it used to be. So the Gulf Stream is now behaving like it's drunk, and it's wobbling way down into over North America in ways that it wouldn't have before. And so, you know, I get it that all the right wingers think that it being so cold is proof that it's not global warming. But in fact, this is the kind of thing that global warming predicts.
Yeah, you try that line at the Tea Party convention and see where it gets you.
Yeah, it would be sort of like saying the world is more than 6,000 years old. I get it. So.
Well, meanwhile, the polar vortex is maybe impacting the work of the Senate today.
How so?
Well, because there are two votes scheduled for today, and senators are coming back from their vacations, and a lot of them fly in via Chicago.
And Chicago shut down?
Well, it's wickedly cold and there are a lot of flight delays and cancellations. But the question is, can enough of them get back to make these votes happen? Or are the votes going to be delayed? It's not clear yet. It looks as though the vote to confirm Janet Yellen to be the next head of the Federal Reserve and the first woman head of the Federal Reserve will go forward at 5:30 Eastern. And this is a very significant vote. It's very likely she will be confirmed. She only needs 51 votes with the elimination of the filibuster for nominations, most nominations. And even though the emphasis really in most conversations today has been about the jobless benefits, the emergency jobless benefits vote, which I'll talk about in a moment, you could make the argument that this vote is more significant for everybody in the country, including the unemployed, and for people internationally than the jobless vote, because it is the chair of the Federal Reserve influencing the Federal Reserve that sets monetary policy that influences the world. This
yes.
is a very significant vote.
Yes.
But the jobless benefits emergency extension is also supposed to come up today. The thing is that the Democrats, it is a bipartisan bill, Dean Heller, Republican of Nevada, and Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, both states with high 9% unemployment, they hope to get this thing through. They need 60 votes. They hope to get 5 Republicans. Can they do it? At this point, it's not clear, and it's not clear whether there will be enough people physically in the Senate to make this happen.
That's fascinating. Now, I remember hearing stories over the years about legislators taking trips on corporate jets. What percentage of our representatives are actually flying on private jets, you know, benefit of J.P. Reynolds or Lorillard or whatever, versus what percentage are always flying? I mean, does John McCain always he's rich enough. His wife is rich enough that she probably owns a private jet, right?
Right.
So he doesn't fly commercial.
I don't know how he flies now, but there has been a huge cutback since some of the excesses and scandals. And Speaker John Boehner runs a very tight ship, you know, ever since he got rid of perks and giveaways and pay-fors and payouts in terms of, you know, if you do this, you'll get a chairmanship, and I'll give you this, and I'll give. Ever since he got rid of all that, you really can't get very much for free in the House.
So most of these guys are actually flying commercial, and they will get stuck in Chicago.
Yeah, they're going to get stuck in Chicago.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, yeah, they're getting stuck. So that's going on.
Yeah.
Also. I don't know whether you've already had this reported, but I'll mention it briefly. The Supreme Court today ordered a temporary stop to same-sex marriages in Utah, where there's been about 900. This is the High Court's first intervention in a new case that asks whether gays have a constitutional right to marry. There was a brief written order with really no explanation coming after a December 20th trial court ruling that struck down state laws limiting marriage to opposite-sex couples. And this is really going to be really interesting because whoever wins, it's going to be referred to the Tenth Circuit based in Denver, whoever wins, whether it's the state of Utah or same-sex couples, this is going straight back to the Supreme Court.
Right. And
that's fascinating.
It is, particularly with at least one member of the Supreme Court possibly being very favorably disposed toward gay marriage.
Yes.
And I probably shouldn't say anything more than that because that's, but in any case, we'll see how this all shakes out.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. Very interesting. Two brief bits of overseas news. The White House today in the briefing that I was covering defended its Iraq strategy, which has been attacked by Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Jay Carney, the press secretary, saying, I don't think I've heard members of Congress suggest this, but if members were suggesting that there should be American troops fighting and dying in Fallujah today, they should say so. The president doesn't believe that. Of course, Fallujah is under a lot of attack at the moment from Sunni militants.
Yeah, and we need to keep in mind that there were no al-Qaeda, no Sunni militants fighting in Iraq before George Bush decided that he was going to bumble into it. Anyway, no comment necessary. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Today is the 73rd anniversary of Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying this.
In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
There you go. It's called the Four Freedoms Speech. Professor Harvey Kay has a new book out, The Fight for the Four Freedoms. Actually, the book is not quite out yet, but I believe you can order it online and certainly from your favorite bookstore. It's called The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. His Twitter is Harvey J. K. K. A. Y. E. He's the professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Professor Harvey Kay, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, hell of a speech. What happened to the Four Freedoms?
Well, first thing to understand, of course, is that Roosevelt knew something about Americans that too many other presidents don't seem to realize, and that is that in the face of crisis, what it means to be an American is you raise the stakes in a progressive way. You don't retreat. And before, through the New Deal years, you know, confronting the Great Depression, through World War II, Roosevelt had confidence in his fellow citizens, and with good reason. He knew what Americans were capable of doing, and he knew what Americans wanted at war's end. And when war's end came, Americans set out to realize those four freedoms, if not always for the world, at least to set up America along those lines. And what happened to it? Rightist reaction. Almost immediately at the end of the war, the right and the corporate rich mobilized to suppress those aspirations. They contested labor organizing, and we end up with the right-wing legislation in Congress known as the Taft-Hartley Act, a whole series of initiatives on the part of big business to not simply, as once upon a time they had, try to suppress the four freedoms, but actually to try to co-opt them and to manipulate them. During the war, there were those who said, well, the four freedoms are good, but we need a fifth freedom, freedom of enterprise, private enterprise, free enterprise. After the war, they accepted that there was they accepted the fact there was probably no going back. At least many of them accepted there was no going back to the days before the New Deal. But the idea of extending freedom, equality, and democracy and pushing the four freedoms even further in America was not on business's agenda, and decidedly not on the conservative agenda.
So, I'd say in a small way, Lyndon Johnson brought that back with the Great Society, although it was so badly tainted and contaminated by the Vietnam War.
Oh, absolutely, Tom. You know, I mean, the same generation that came of age in the Great Depression and advanced the New Deal by their own laborers in the CCC and the WPA and then went on to fight in World War II, and with these 16 million young Americans, they enter middle age in the 1960s. And I actually would argue that it's that same generation that issues the call for the Great Society, issues the call for civil rights, issues the call for many of the progressive initiatives of the 60s, and ends up enacting them, basically, you know, pushed and encouraged by, well, you're in my generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the boomers,
those
the
are
generation that followed.
Entering into our teen and early adulthood in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. And where are we now? I mean, now it seems like we have...
Well, I think for 40 years now, ever since Ronald Reagan, and maybe even to some extent, I think under Jimmy Carter in the 70s, we've seen a war against the four freedoms. And we've even seen a retreat on the part of Democrats after four decades, in their commitment to advancing those four freedoms. In fact, I have an idea. It seems to me that we progressives ought to sort of set up a scorecard. There are those who like to set up a scorecard on how much the national debt grows, or William Bennett's scorecard on what happened to American values. Well, we need to set up a scorecard in which we keep a record of just how much our liberal and progressive politicians actually pursue the four freedoms, right? Hmm. We ought to be asking ourselves regularly, are they actually trying to live up to the democratic aspirations of the greatest generation, which we ourselves carry forth, but we don't necessarily advance effectively?
Hmm. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Freedom from fear is basically, let's not have war around the world. The UN was, you know, the hope, the great hope for that. Freedom from want, though, I think is the most interesting. FDR made government the employer of last resort. When capitalism fails, government would step in with the CCC, the WPA, and all those other agencies. Why aren't we turning to that? Why? What has happened to that idea that, you know, where FDR said the best welfare program is a job? When did we lose that, Harvey? Professor K.
We lost that somewhere in the course of the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. I mean, one of the things is that right after the war, there were those labor leaders who recognized that they had to work with liberals to advance the agenda. But they were concerned that even liberals seemed to see the agenda as something that was pursued in Congress, that was a series of legislative initiatives. And by the 1950s and 60s, labor lost, except for public employees perhaps, but labor lost that drive to advance the four freedoms from the bottom up.
Lost a lot of their power because of Taft-Hartley in 47.
Well, they did, except they lost their power of, basically to advance in the South.
Right.
In the, you know, right. I mean, that's where
right.
That's,
the old
I mean,
South. Yeah. The old
Northeast,
Confederate
and
states.
California things advanced.
Right.
But it's in the South where they lost that effort. And unfortunately, you know, the alliance between labor and civil rights was a very, very uneven one. Labor did underwrite many civil rights struggles and initiatives, you know, the UAW and others, and some of the predominantly black unions. But the Civil Rights Labor Alliance just wasn't strong enough and probably should have been more effective in advancing not just civil rights, but civil rights and workers' rights in the South during the 1960s. I mean, considering the majority of African Americans in the South were themselves working people. So I don't know I don't think it was lost at that time. But I think, you know,
has the South won?
We have
just a few seconds left. Has the South won? Are we in, you know, since the Bush presidency?
Well, the South has won if you consider that for 40 years we've been living under a kind of Reagan New Right agenda. The trick is, do we turn the tide in 2014, 2016, and start advancing the four freedoms in a new way? That's the question.
That is absolutely the question. Professor Harvey Kaye, his new book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Harvey J. Kaye on Twitter.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Professor Kaye, thanks so much for being with us today. Great having you with us. We'll be back. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert in Great Court, South Carolina. Hey, Robert.
Yes, I'm happy to know that Roosevelt made his speech about the four freedoms on my birthday.
Well, happy birthday, Robert.
Thank you very much. That's real interesting to know. I always wondered what happened, what events were occurring on my birthday.
Yeah, well, that's a big one. It was a big one.
All right, thank you for that bit of information.
You're welcome, and thank you for calling and saying hi on that. Charlotte in Fresno, California. Hey, Charlotte, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Well, thank you. I just wanted to see what you would think of having a co-presidency. Now, this is not my idea. I heard it somewhere. I can't remember when, but it was like last October with the shutdown of the government and so on. People were getting frustrated, and I heard the idea then. By the co-presidency, I mean one from each party, so that we would be electing a Democratic and a Republican president at the same time, and they would coexist,
right,
share the office, share the work, and have to get along.
Yeah, like they're doing in the UK right now with David Cameron and what's his name? Nick Clegg, I think his name is, the new Labour leader. And I think it would be a disaster. And and I refer you to a book by Dan Sisson called The Revolution of 1800, which is out of print right now. It'll be coming back into print in a year or so, but you can buy used copies. The Revolution of 1800, with the election of Thomas Jefferson, that was the election in which Jefferson beat Adams. And it was a true revolution. And there was a sense among the revolutionary generation, the generation that birthed this country, that whatever party was in control, whatever group was in control, whatever faction was in control, basically everybody should go along with them because they had the majority of the country on their side. And so they represented, you know, this being a democracy and a republic, they represented the will of the people. And the people who worked to impede the efforts of the other side were virtually traitors. And that's the reason why when John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798, a law that Thomas Jefferson felt was totally unconstitutional, was totally wrong, was morally wrong, was legally wrong, was wrong in every way possible. And Jefferson was vice president of the United States at that time. And President John Adams signed this law. Jefferson didn't stand up and speak out against it. He didn't try to organize opposition to it. Instead, he left town. He refused to be in Washington, D.C., in the District of the Goddess, when that law was signed, because he felt that it was a desecration of the district. It was a desecration of America, but he didn't organize an opposition to it. Instead, he organized the next election. And so, you know, the founding generation would have been horrified by this gridlock in Congress. They would say that the minority party should go along with the majority party, that, you know, and that's the way it should be. And we've got this idea that we're supposed to have blocked government and locked up government and contentious, you know, government, and that's really not what the founders had in mind, Charles. And I think that a co-presidency would make things even worse in that direction, and I think it is in the UK. Charlotte, thanks for the call. It's an interesting thought, and it's thought-provoking. It leads to a lot of different areas to ponder. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jerry in Libertyville, Illinois. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I originally wanted to talk about the global warming and the reason for these cold snaps.
Right.
I have a PhD in the science field, and one of the things that I think is I don't like the term climate change as much as global warming, because the climate has to do with the atmosphere. In the atmosphere, when you talk about the total heat budget, it's big, but it's not as big as the globe itself.
Right. The oceans are absorbing, what, 80%, almost 90% of the heat?
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started getting curious about, you know, they talk about these storms and what's driving, you know, the cold in the air. And when you do the calculations, just the adiabatic cooling of a gallon of water, you know, just becoming vapor and then going up and then raining, there's a heat exchange there of 2.1 million calories. And when you do the math on that and you figure out, you know, how much heat loss occurs, you know, like a storm like Sandy or this one in the Philippines with Ion or something like that.
Right.
I don't know if I pronounced
that
name right. For every day that storm is near its peak, that's 275,000 atomic bombs worth of heat escaping the atmosphere.
Right.
And
being taken out of the air and put into the form of condensed water that's falling into the oceans ultimately.
Right. And that heat's gone. It's gone out of the atmosphere. So, yeah, you know, that stuff.
And into the ocean.
Well, no, it's mostly going into the atmosphere. It's leaving the globe. It's leaving the atmosphere, and it's gone.
No, it's not. You know, it's the second law of thermodynamics. It's not vanishing. That heat is now in held by water, liquid water rather than water vapor, and that water is falling on the earth. In part, the earth is warmed by it. Most of it ends up eventually in the oceans, and the oceans are warmed by it. This is why the oceans are absorbing 80 to 90% of the heat from, you know, they were trying to account for, you know, all this global warming that should be happening over the last 50 years. It has been happening more slowly than the early predictions, and they figured out that the reason why is because so much of it is sinking its way into the oceans. And it's not just the oceans absorbing it out of the air. It's that when water vapor condenses out of the air, as you correctly point out, it absorbs, you know, thermal energy. It absorbs heat out of the air. But that heat doesn't just vanish.
No,
that heat
backwards.
Goes into the water.
That's backwards. No, that's backwards. It wouldn't rain. It wouldn't rain if the water still had heat in it. This is what happens.
Well, it doesn't. You know, you can have heat below 32 degrees.
Listen to me. I got a, you know.
Or below 212 degrees.
100 credits of science to figure this out. Here's the thing. The oceans warm up.
Right.
You have more humidity. That's why you have more snow. But the water will not fall from the sky unless the heat is left up there. Remember that things go from heat to cold, and the heat will go into the cold. It'll go into space. And when the water falls, that heat's left up there. And that heat is gone. So that's why, you know, as you have more and more of these storms, you have a tremendous cooling effect on the atmosphere. Now, the same thing happens in your refrigerator. When you have a compressor in there, and then there's little valves, and then the gas in there expands in the cooling coils, and it absorbs the heat.
Right.
And then that's why it's cool inside the refrigerator. Then the compressor takes that gas, and it compresses it back into a liquid, and then you feel the heat coming out in the coils behind your refrigerator. So if you have a situation like the Earth, the evaporation at the oceans, for every gallon of water that evaporates, that's 2.1 million calories to evaporate that. That's high energy, high heat steam. And it expands 1,600 times.
Yeah.
In other words, there's 1,600 gallons.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I understand the math, and I understand the physics of it. What I'm suggesting to you is, if I can summarize what I think you're saying, what I think you're saying is that you believe that when evaporation in the atmosphere occurs or there is loss of heat, that there's more radiative cooling from the planet. Is that what you're suggesting, that it's going into outer space, you said?
Well, the storms are what's cooling.
Okay, I would submit to you that it is not, it is that radiative cooling is not being affected by the temperature of the planet or by the intensity of storms, that what we have is a closed system here, and that there is heat as long as you're at, you know, above zero Kelvin, you know, whether you're, you know, and you can have water in a gaseous form below 212 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't have to boil. It can, you know, you can have water vapor, anything above 32 degrees. So right now we have 5% more moisture in the atmosphere than we had 30 years ago, in part because of the added heat, right? And that heat is driving that moisture out, not so much from the oceans, frankly, but from plant life, actually. You know, because the air is warmer and there's more moisture being absorbed. So that 5% more moisture, as that moisture forms into storms, as cold air hits wet air or hits warm air, it condenses out. You're right. It sucks heat out, but the heat is being held in water droplets, and it's falling as rain relatively warm rain. And then getting its way back into the oceans. That's the point that I'm making. That it's a closed.
Yeah, that's not true.
It's a closed
system. I'll send you an email and explain this to you.
Okay. All right. You do that, Jim. Thank you very much. I may well be wrong. I'm perfectly willing to accept that. In fact, I probably am. I'm not a physicist. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The four freedoms. Freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. How do you think we're doing on these? Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciated the information that you gave about the option that will happen in 2016 where states on their own can go for a single-payer health care.
Right, yeah. Vermont has already enacted it legislatively. In fact, Peter Shumlin was the head of the Senate, and in 2012, I think it was, maybe it was the 2010, no, it must have been the 2010 election, he ran for governor on the platform of elect me governor and I will shepherd this single-payer legislation through the Vermont legislature. He did, he signed it into law last year or the year before, and it is now poised to go into place. The legislature has put together an organization to figure out how to administer it.
Interesting. I shared that with a retired doctor friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
and I told him good news that will be the case. And he said, "Well, number one, wouldn't the people have to vote on that first?" That was his one.
The people
question.
Did. They elected those representatives and senators,
right.
And governor.
Number two, he said, "Why would single payer be any less expensive than the current system that we have, which is the Obamacare system?" And shame on me, I couldn't answer. I've heard so many times that it is less expensive; it would be more economical to do, but I couldn't go into detail.
Well, I would refer you to a movie that Robert's name, Brave New Films, Brave New Pictures,
yeah.
Robert Greenwald made.
Yeah.
and about health care, and I'm missing, pardon? No, I'm missing the name of it. There's a whole website for it and everything else, where he shows the homes of the CEOs of the health insurance companies. And Stephen Hemsley, for example, the CEO of United Healthcare, has taken over $1 billion in compensation from that company. His predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, had taken $1.7 billion in compensation as CEO of United Healthcare. And so, you know, I mean, where did that money come from? That money came from people paying in premiums and then being told, no, we're not going to cover that operation, or no, your kid is not covered for this, or we're going to dump your plan because you hit $1 million lifetime, cost with that particular cancer or surgery or whatever. And that's where every single penny of that $1 billion that Stephen Hemsley has made, and the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars that his colleagues, the CEOs of the other big health insurance companies, have made, and the 100 or so senior executives at United Healthcare who each make more than $1 million a year, they're bankers. These health insurance companies are banks. They don't give immunizations. They don't look in kids, tonsils in their throats at their tonsils. They don't change bedpans. They move money. And they move money in ways that make them a profit. And so Medicare operates on a 3% overhead. And this is typical of the single-payer healthcare systems all around Europe and in Costa Rica and in Central and South America. It's typically a single-payer healthcare system run by a government entity runs on anywhere from 2-4% as total overhead costs. That's what it costs to administer it, okay?
Right.
To handle all the paperwork, cut the checks, all that kind of thing, because everything is centralized.
And his objection...
Let me just finish this. Our healthcare system running through our health insurance companies right now at its most efficient is 20%, because that's what the Obamacare law set it at. It said you can't take more than 20%. You can't skim more than 20% off the top, 25% if you're a small health insurance company. A lot of these health insurance companies were running on 30, 35, and 40% profit margins or cost margins.
Where the refund checks came from?
Pardon?
That's where the refund checks started coming.
That's right. The refund checks came to us because that part of Obamacare kicked in last year and said if you took more than 20 or 25% if you're a smaller company, then you have to refund that money.
And his objection was you're going to trust one insurance company that's run by the state. How would that be a good situation to have? And you know what? I couldn't answer that question.
Okay, well, let me give you the answer to that. Would you rather have an insurance company where if you go down to United Healthcare's headquarters and you say, I want to talk to Stephen Hemsley, I want to talk to the CEO, they will say no. And you say, well, I'm going to sit here in the office until he comes out and sees me. They will have you arrested for trespassing. If you go to your elected member of Congress's office and say, I'd like to talk to my member of Congress, they may well say no. But if you say, I'm going to sit here until, the cows come home, they can't have you arrested. I mean, there's a certain point, I suppose, but they can't have you prosecuted for trespass. It just doesn't happen. You can't, if you were to stand out in front of United Healthcare with a sign saying, United Healthcare screwed me because, with the details or whatever, and organized movements and things, they're not going to change their policies because of that. You can't vote Stephen Hemsley out as CEO of United Healthcare. You can, however, vote out your elected representatives. If you don't like the way your health insurance is being run by the government, by your government, see, your friend is assuming that the government is not his government. He's assuming that the government is some, distant, separate entity. And I know libertarians like to think that way, and Republicans like to act that way until they get in power, and then they take everything they can from government. But the fact of the matter is that what's so extraordinary about the American experiment and has been copied by other developed democracies around the world is that the government is us. And that's why in every country in the world, every developed democracy in the world has, of the 34 OECD countries, we're the only one that doesn't have a national healthcare system. And in every single one of them, they're administered by and large by the government. The exception is Switzerland, and Switzerland has set up a system where the government manages the administration of it. And it's administered by the government, and the government is answerable to the people. And if it doesn't work, the people raise hell and the government fixes it. And the best example of that, I guess, is, you know, over the years, the many zigs and zags of the British healthcare system.
So is it Green Mountain, the healthcare that's the proposed healthcare company that's going to be handling Vermont?
Yeah, it's not a company. It's that's the brand that the state came up with.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, that's just what they're calling it, is Green Mountain Healthcare. Yeah, and the movie is Sick for Profit, and the website is sickforprofit.com. If you go and watch that movie, you get to see the these incredibly fabulously expensive homes that are owned by all these health insurance CEOs and the private jets and the luxurious vacations and the million-dollar birthday parties and things like that. That's why you would want to – that, you know, it's the same thing with Social Security. Would you rather, you know, Social Security has never failed to pay a check. Social Security's administrative overheads costs 2 to 3%. Would you really rather have the guys in Wall Street handling Social Security?
And isn't it interesting that the same guy said, well, Social Security's not a government-run thing, but he was anti-government. But if I could ask you one more kind of a simple question, over and over he keeps telling me, who I don't think anybody – this is him talking. I don't think anybody read the 1,600 pages in Obamacare. And I don't argue with him, but in my mind, I think to myself, of course the senators, you tell me if I'm correct, of course the senators don't read it. They have staff that reads all that.
Well, and not only that, every single one of those 1,600 pages was litigated ad nauseum over a two-year period while this thing was dragged out in Congress.
Thank you.
In dozens of committees, by the way, in several committees. There were several different committees that worked on this. Every single word was examined. So, yeah, Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have to downshift about five different gears by now. I want to get back to the 60 Minutes.
Sure. Yeah, why has 60 Minutes become like Fox News?
I'm so thrilled that somebody is bringing this up. And I guess, actually, in my mind, this goes back to the Dan Rather.
Firing. Yeah.
Which I still don't understand and can't wrap my mind around. But let me put it in very, very quick personal terms. I have a very close relative, a 72-year-old, white, suburban, middle-class female, who used to be maybe a Reagan supporter, but fiscally conservative, socially at least liberal, if not progressive. But over the last 10 years, I've watched become further and further seduced by Fox News.
Right.
But going back to the 70s, I grew up in a house where 60 Minutes was on my TV every Sunday night.
Yep. Same here.
60 Minutes, at least I had always thought, this is one place, because this person is still a diehard watcher, to get some counterbalance.
Right.
To get some, and this apparently has dissipated.
Not just dissipated. I think it's flipped. I think when Laura Logan did that piece on Benghazi that played right into the whole Republican conspiracy theory and Daryl Issa and everything, that was basically their coming out party as the new Fox News.
Well, and I agree with that, but that's what I'm saying. I think this actually goes back a little further than that.
Oh, sure.
But it's so subtle.
Yeah. Back to the Iraq War.
Yes, and I hate to say, I don't think it's accidental.
No, I don't think so either. I think it has to do with money. I think it has to do with who are the advertisers, and also with market share. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the suits at CBS, particularly since they hired one of the senior news guys away from Fox, just have decided, hey, those Fox viewers, that's an audience. We can make some money there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Thanks for the call, Michelle. I appreciate it. I think you're spot on. We'll be right back. 15 minutes before. Welcome back. I'm checking, and it looks like the Senate has not yet. Victoria had said that the Senate might vote at 5:30 on the extending unemployment benefits, but apparently that vote has not yet happened. Oh, and Stephanie Miller started today on Free Speech TV. Isn't that great? So if you're watching the show and you don't know who Stephanie Miller is, you got to check her out. And are they carrying all 3 hours of her show, Shane? All 3 hours of the show, and her show is on what 9 a.m. Eastern, so it's 9 to noon Eastern? 9 to noon Eastern. So, and which would be 6 to 9 a.m. on the West Coast, and you know how to do the math in between if you live in one of the in-between states. So be sure to check out right here on Free Speech TV, the Stephanie Miller Show, tomorrow morning between 9 and noon. I think you'll find it. Stephanie's a friend and brilliant. Her dad was Bill Miller, who was Barry Goldwater's running mate in 1964. And when I first met Stephanie, I told her, you know, when I was 13 years old, I went door to door for your dad. And it's true. I did. And I think she wasn't at that point. Stephanie's quite a bit younger than I am. Or she was wee little. She does not remember that, but I remember it well. And her dad was a decent man. He was a decent Republican, which was, you know, that was back in the days when they had decent Republicans. Anyway. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, thank you. And I thrown that thing about Stephanie Miller. In 2004, I was so depressed when I was driving the wheel, the radio, and I was searching for it, and I found her on America. One of those stations.
Yeah, it was if it was out of Boston, it was Revolution Radio or something like that, and the old
right.
Boston Air America station. Yeah.
I mean, I felt like there was someone else alive besides me.
Yeah.
And so she's great.
She's what?
She's great.
Yeah, she is. She really is. Yeah. And now she's on Free Speech TV, too. So that's super.
Yeah, I can't wait to stop. I want to drop network TV completely with the commercials and that's nonsense.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, two things. Was one of these things is sort of mine. It might not be mine, but I noticed the corporate imposed slavery, they used to say wage slaves, but now it's corporate imposed slavery. I realize, I look back when I was working, all these people that I worked with, they were wage slaves,
mm-hmm.
not just wage slaves, but you know, one guy I know, he. When I saw him just before he retired, he had a pickup truck and a son and a wife, and he was going back to his home, and all he had to wait for was Social Security. This
right.
is in 1981, 82.
Yeah.
So the other thing I want to ask you about is I heard something on Free Speech TV. It was very important. He said...
Real quick, Frank.
Well, maybe giving intelligence to...
Frank, I'm sorry, we're out of time. You're going to have to call back another time. I'm really sorry. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And my apologies when the machine begins. Our brakes are hard, so our stations know exactly when they're happening. I can't turn them on or turn them off. Annette in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, Annette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm sorry, I'm on speakerphone. The gentleman that called in earlier asking, with the physician friend that was asking why or how it can be less expensive, I think the biggest reason, and I think it's important for people to know this, is because of administrative costs.
Hmm.
I think Medicare is like 3-4%.
Yes.
And private health care is like 14%, and the figures may be higher than that since the last time I looked into it. Another thing is there's Physicians for National Health Care. They have a wonderful website. They have more information about single-payer health care, and you can donate or join. You don't have to be a physician.
It's PNHC.org is their website.
Yeah.
Yes, I keynoted their conference about five, maybe 8 years ago. Yeah, it's a great organization.
And let's see. I guess that's all except that I had a friend who, like 30, 35 years ago, worked with a physician that later became the CEO of Aetna. And he helicoptered to work every day. There was someone whose job it was to come in and light his fireplace in his office. And those are just the two things I can remember, because that's pretty outrageous.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
No one does that.
Yeah, that's living the high life. Annette, thank you for the call. And you're right. It's the administrative costs. And then on top of that, a for-profit company not only has the administrative costs, because they're a bureaucracy just as much as a government is, but they also have to pay the CEO an outrageous sum. Plus, they've got to pay dividends to their stockholders. Plus, they've got to pay for advertising and marketing. Plus, they've got, you know, all the competitive costs. And you've got multiple companies in the marketplace. You're replicating that over and over and over again. Why not just have one single payer do it, the government? Tom in Seattle listening on KBCS. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to briefly mention two books and make a comment. Two books, Power Elite by C. Wright Mills. And the other book is The Crash of 2016 by Tom Hartman. You wrote the sequel to The Power Elite.
Really?
Awesome book. Just amazing. And Eisenhower's farewell speech, Military-Industrial-Congressional Complex. And Congressional was crossed out, edited, and his daughter Susan, you can actually see the document where Congressional was crossed out because his advisors suggested that he do so he wouldn't cause such a stir. But it is the Military-Industrial-Congressional Complex, and Power Elite in your book, Tom, is just awesome. And you've read The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills.
I have not. I'm not familiar with it.
Tom. The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills. You need to read it.
I will check it out.
You and C. Wright Mills are soulmates. You wrote the book in 1956.
Yeah.
You wrote it in 1956. Everything is in there. Tom, the 80-year increments that you discussed. John Adams, Roosevelt. It is all. He is. You have carried the torch of this book, The Power Elite, and it brought it to present day. I am I'm shaking right now because the words in your books are, it's like your twins. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Wow.
I will
order a copy this afternoon.
Please. And the last thing I want to say is Boeing makes drones, and in that statement alone, you have the whole history of the military-industrial-congressional complex. Just think about it. Boeing, World War II, all the way to present, and the things that you talk about in your book hit every single note of exactly what's going on. And I appreciate your program, and you have the public domain. Public is something that hardly exists anymore because the government, the corporations, and the military all speak to the masses, and that's a one-way street. You, Tom, provide a two-way street. You provide people like myself and others to dialogue with you and give a print opinions and values, and there is exchange, and that is what happens in the public comments. But it is rare. It is rare. It is rare. And you are one of very few in the public domain. Everything else, whether it's Fox News or whatever you want to call it, just speaks to the masses, and it's a one-way street.
Yeah.
I'm rambling on because you got to read that book.
Okay. No, I promise you, Tom, I will order the book. You have absolutely impressed me with the importance of it, and I just have 1 minute left in the show today, so I want to try and get one more caller in. So thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan. Hey, Johnny, you want me to explain freedom from want?
Well, yeah. What I know about it is like, you know, the heart wants, the belly needs. Okay, you ever see a movie called Two Bits?
No.
Al Pacino?
No, I didn't.
It's about he's dying in the backyard, and it's a day during the Depression. His grandson wants to go to the movies. He's going to get a quarter if when he dies.
Uh-huh.
And his dying breath, he tells his son, "Want," his grandson, and he doesn't understand what he's meaning. He says, "Want." In other words, don't stop wanting.
Oh yeah. Well, what FDR was saying, and he said it in 1936 in his speech in Philadelphia, in July of 1936, he said, an old judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. If you're homeless, you're not free. If you're jobless, you're not free. You're compelled by the force of nature. There is a force against you that you're confronting. And so when he was talking about freedom from want, that's what he was talking about, that everybody should have the basic, you know, the basic needs met, the need for health care, the need for food, the need for housing, and you can get that with a decent job. So coming up tomorrow, we'll continue the show. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.